Jai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nivasesa Sanyavadi Paskachade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavam Chashi Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
March 14, 2016, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 10, Text 13. Yate danim tadagre cha.
Yate danim tadagre cha.
Paschadape taridrisham.
Paschadam yetanidrisham.
Please chant. Yata.
Yata.
As it is.
Yata. As it is.
Idanim.
Idanim.
At present.
At present.
At present.
Tata.
Ta-da.
So it was.
So it was.
So it was.
Agre.
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 In the beginning.
Cha.
Cha.
And. Paschat.
Paschat.
At the end.
At the end.
Api.
Api.
Also. Etat idrisham. It continues to be the same. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The cosmic manifestation is as it is now. It was the same in the past, and it will continue the same way in the future. Purport. There is a systematic schedule for the perpetual manifestation, maintenance, and annihilation of the material world. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 9.8, Bhuta Gramam Imam Kritsnam Avasam Prakriter Vashat. As it is created now, and as it will be destroyed later on, so also it existed in the past, and again will be created, maintained, and destroyed in due course of time. Therefore, the systematic activities of the time factor are perpetual and eternal, and cannot be stated to be false. The manifestation is temporary and occasional, but it is not false, as claimed by the Mayavadi philosophers. Yate danim tatagre cha paschad apye taridrisham. This cosmic manifestation is as it is now. It was the same in the past, and it will continue the same way in the future. A little depressing, huh? Whatever it is now is what it was and what it will be. Jaya Dorje Maharaj has written a book called Vanity Karma. And he speaks a lot about this, right? He's working from Ecclesiastes of the Bible. And basically it's saying everything is vanity, nothing is going to change, everything is the way it is, there's nothing new under the sun, and everything is just useless because everything's going to go on in its own way. And I think we see that. We see that regardless of the reformers, things stay the same. I was just reading in Ishopanishad, Prabhupada saying, you know, if you want to go back to Godhead, you can go there. If you want to go to the place of the demigods, you can go there. He said, if you want to stay here with your planning commissions, and you can stay here. And we see that, you know, so many politicians come and go, so many philanthropists come and go, philosophers come and go, and the world goes on. There's winter, spring, summer, and fall. There's destruction, there's again creation, and things basically go on. You know, some important person, just like, you know, we think, well, if this person dies, everything will fall apart, but the world goes on. Obviously, some people have a greater impact on the world than others, but both negatively and positively. But basically, everything goes on. No matter how important the person is who is born, no matter how important the person is who dies, people are still eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. People are still being born. I mean, it's interesting. I originally joined social media, particularly Facebook, because a friend of mine told me that that way I could have a free web page. So it's not exactly like that, because Facebook is controlling how you show things, etc. And now my granddaughter set up 2 web pages for me. But one thing I noticed on Facebook is if I spend 5-10 minutes just scrolling through the news feed and seeing, you know, what people are doing. So somebody's been born. Someone's celebrating a birth. Somebody's mourning a death. Somebody's kid has just started school. Somebody's kid has just graduated school. Somebody just got married. Somebody just got divorced. Somebody just moved. Whatever human beings are doing, somebody that I know indirectly or directly, it's happening to them. And for them, it's a big event, you know. I've had a baby, I got married, my wife died. You know, for them, it's major. But when you start seeing it in this scroll of it's happening to everybody, then you get a little different perspective on it. You see that this is, it's just life. It's just part of life. You get this kind of detachment from it. So Krishna is telling Lord Brahma, it's all, whatever's happened in the past is happening in the present and will happen in the future. As again, as it says in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. And at the same time, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that material nature is endlessly mutable. So the specific forms of it are always changing. Right? Even Krishna comes and he has a similar series of leelas. But they're not exactly the same. You know, Varaha comes in a white manifestation and he doesn't kill a demon. And he comes in a red manifestation and he does kill a demon. And one of the confusing things about the Bhagavatam, if one is looking at it as a purely chronological historical narrative, which is not what it is at all, is that it will combine, the speakers will combine, okay, let me take this part from this appearance of Varaha and this part from this appearance of Varaha and put it together into kind of a conglomerate story, right? But there's this cycle going on, although the details are always different. Right? The details are always different, even if you have, you know, the same oatmeal porridge for breakfast every morning, it's going to be a little different. It's going to be a little bit thicker or a little bit thinner. And even if you follow the recipe, right? Nowadays, we like to do things in a factory, mechanically, so that everything is exactly the same. That's not Krishna's way. Krishna's way, so many trees are outside my window. Each species of tree, subspecies, has a different shape of leaf, different color of bark, and on the same tree, each leaf is different. And yet, you can say, although each leaf on the tree is different, and each tree of the same species and subspecies is different, still you've seen it before. The tree grows, it gets big, maybe it gets eaten by bugs, and it dies. It produces its fruits, its flowers, its buds, and it withers, and this is the bhutva paliyate. Everything is being, as here Prabhupada's quoting, bhutva gramyam imam kritsnam avasham prakritir vashat. So Prabhupada's talking here about the fact that everything has always existed means that it is eternal. It is not false. So such an understanding is of great hope for us, that the material nature has reality. There is some meaning to it. there's some meaning in its the fact that it is eternal, even though it's the world of names and a changing forms. And looking at these two things, that material nature in its essence is eternal, and yet its particular manifestation is constantly shifting. And we can ask ourselves, how do we deal with material nature? Can we really be a reformer? Can we really reform material nature? So that material nature is eternal. There's a class of philosophers, including most Christians, who say that the cosmos, the world, was created from nothing. So the majority of the scientific community say that the world was created from nothing. The majority of the Christians agree that the world was created from nothing. God took nothing and created a world. However, it's interesting that that scientists would have such a theory when Einstein postulated that matter is never created or destroyed. It changes from energy to matter and matter to energy, and it can change the form of matter. But nothing is ever destroyed. Everything is, there's nothing that's added, and there's nothing that's taken away, which is very much what Krishna is saying here in this verse. Everything, there's a status. Everything's in status. So we agree with this concept that nothing is created or destroyed. We agree that everything is in status. So right now I'm using energy to speak and energy to think. And that energy was yesterday a sandwich. Right? My grandson made sandwiches for dinner last night. So it was wheat and rye and cheese and lettuce and tomatoes. So the tomato has transformed into my energy of speaking and thinking. Right? And again, that energy will transform into matter. Right? So it's constantly shifting. Where did the tomato come from? It came from the air. It came from the sun. It came from the water. So as I'm speaking, I'm producing water vapor. The tongue is associated also with fire. I'm producing carbon monoxide, which the trees are then breathing. And so these things are not, I'm not really adding something. I'm just changing its form. I'm changing the way it's manifested. And what's lovely about this is that there's some reality to material nature. It has some meaning. Generally, life seems, if you really meditate on it, it seems pretty meaningless. This was the conclusion of the speaker of Ecclesiastes, that life is basically meaningless. And again, if we think about things philosophically, it seems that way. That whether I'm born or I die, whether I'm healthy or sick, my effect on the world is negligible. Right? Each one of us, when we die, there's only a very tiny, tiny percentage of the human beings on the planet who will even notice. I'm sure we have the experience that we become ill or injured, and very few people are even cognizant of it. I mean, I've been sick, and the people in the same room as me are not aware that I'm sick, and I even say to them, you know, I'm sick, I have a fever, and 10 minutes later they've forgotten. So we see that what we're doing, or, you know, with our great accomplishments. Now, the grandchildren will come to me, and, you know, I drew this picture, and for them it's, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours of work that they put into the intricacies of the picture. And I may give it a cursory glance and say, you know, oh, very nice, very nice. And we find that with ourselves, too. You know, I'm right now I'm working on a detailed academic paper about the history of education in ISKCON. And, you know, you think about it, well, who's going to really care? We're going to be presenting it. There's going to be a conference in Harvard University on the Hare Krishna movement. And, you know, you wonder how many of the people who are listening really care. Are they really just waiting for a chance to say their own paper? Are they really going to listen to my paper? If it gets published, is anyone going to read it? If anybody reads it, will it change anything? I mean, I remember when I did my detailed research on a full census of all the teachers in the Hare Krishna movement back in 2005, 2006, and when I wanted to present it, I found that practically nobody was interested. I said, you know, we have information here that's never been shared that would really affect how we structure education in ISKCON, and oh, we're too busy. We have, Yeah, we have something else to do. It. And I had thought, well, I'm putting a year and a half of my life into this. I want to do something important. And it was kind of a shock to find out that very, very, very few people shared my enthusiasm for it being important. And, you know, the other students warned me within a month, your family members will get tired of hearing about it. You won't be able to talk to them anymore. That was a fact. So we may see that the material nature seems very meaningless to us, that those who are near and dear to us, our parents, our spouse, our children, you know, that even they have a limited amount of interest in what we're doing. Their degree of actual, real, in-depth interest and appreciation is very minimal. their interest in sharing our enthusiasm for something, it tends to be they're all interested in themselves. And our ability to change things. You know, you can work for so long. There was a song I remember when I was a kid. It said, I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, and I guess I'll just remain the same. And we feel like that about ourselves. You know, I put so much effort into reforming myself and changing myself. Some of it has an effect, but a lot of it doesn't. There's parts of my nature. I mean, Krishna tells us this. There are parts of my nature that just are what they are, in this life. And no matter what I try to do to change them or modify them, they just simply stubbornly stay what they are. You push something and it gradually goes back to what it was. And if I have such a difficulty changing myself, you know, how am I going to change others? So we think like that, you know, I'll be a counselor, I'll be an advisor, I'll be a teacher. And we glorify the reformers. But it is as it is now. It was the same in the past. It will continue in the same way in the future. It just stays what it is. Things go back to status. In fact, this fact of things going back to status is very much opposed to the whole concept of evolution. So opposed to the concept of evolution in the beginning, that things can't come from nothing. The idea of something coming from nothing is opposed to the most basic concept of science, that energy and matter is never destroyed, it's just transformed. And then the other idea of evolution is things are always getting better and better and better. You know, pretty soon humans are going to evolve to get wings or something like that. But we find that things go back to status. So let's say that parents give birth to a child who's a genius, and two geniuses marry each other. You know, they don't keep producing a race of geniuses. Eventually things go back to the average. And such is true even scientists who breed plants and animals. Of course, Krishna was taught how to breed at least plants when he went to Gurukul. But they find with breeding there's a limit. You can go with the breeding. There's a limit as to how much you can improve that particular breed. You reach a boundary. And when you start pushing the boundary, you end up with bad qualities that outweigh whatever advantages that you're trying to get. It's interesting. In Europe now, there's a big market for a certain kind of milk that has a certain kind of protein in it. And evidently, particularly the Holstein cows, which have been bred in the Western world to give huge quantities of low butterfat milk, they have a different kind, their milk has a different kind of protein. And the protein in the milk of Holstein cows reacts negatively with large numbers of people. Whereas the cows that weren't, you know, bred to give these huge quantities of milk, they have the original kind of milk protein, which people can more easily digest. And people in certain parts of the world are now paying a premium price for what they call A2 milk. So my point is that they're pushing and pushing and pushing. You know, how can we improve? How can we improve? But things go back to the average. And even in the cycle, Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Kali Yuga. So Satya Yuga human beings are living for 100,000 years, and they have great subtle powers, and they're very pious, and gradually, things go down to the Kali Yuga where, you know, we don't even have very many gross powers, might to speak of subtle powers, and things fall apart. And then again, it goes back, and again, it, It doesn't stay low. It doesn't stay high. I had some interesting conversations with a friend of mine who does a lot of investment of funds. And he was telling me the main mistake that people make is they don't just leave the money where it is. They're constantly buying and selling, he says. You know, when you leave the money where it is, if you have decent investments, unless something catastrophic happens or amazing happens, he says, you know, things just sort of even out. They just go kind of within a range, back and forth, up and down. Right? So this is the status of material nature. You can say, well, what about in the final pralaya? In the final pralaya, everything is destroyed. Well, no, it's not destroyed. It's still conserved in the pradhan. And everything that is here now is still in the pradhan. So the difference is that it's no longer manifesting its forms. So this is the illusion is not whether or not material nature exists. Material nature is eternal. The illusion is whether or not the particular forms and manifestations that we see right now are real. They are real in the sense that the substance they are made of is ultimately real. It comes from Krishna and it's never destroyed. It has no beginning and it has no end. But it's what's unreal, what's the illusion, is that these particular forms have any kind of real meaning at all. So, you know, this table, this computer, this chair, they're really existing for a moment. Their existence is so ephemeral. I mean, our little human life in this Kali Yuga, you know, 100 years, if we're lucky, is at 8 billionths of a second of the universe. So what to speak of something that exists, you know, I have this pen here, so what fraction of my life will this pen exist for? If it exists for a few years. So it's not even a noticeable bubble. Right? It's not even a noticeable bubble. We say the world is a world of names only. The forms are constantly shifting. Just like when you're in a dream, you know, you're having a dream and you're in a house and all of a sudden the house becomes a different house. All of a sudden it becomes a field and you didn't exactly walk from one place to another. It's just shifted. It's constantly changing forms, changing manifestations, just like a film where you've got three different color lights on the screen and they're constantly changing, just the three lights, and they're constantly changing what they're displaying. Right? They're constantly changing the forms that they're showing. So that's false. It's just the world of names. What's false is that, you know, I'm your mother, I'm your sister, I'm your brother, that's false. I'm an American, I'm an African. Now, that has no real meaning. And ultimately, what's false is the concept that I have anything to do with this world and that this world is enjoyable for me. That this is my place of enjoyment, that this is my place of action, this is my karma bhumi, this is my field of activity. And here I am the doer, and here I'm going to change something. That's what's false. Because the eternal substance is kind of like you have this non-hardening clay and you make something out of it and then you can pound it back down and you make something else out of it and you pound it back down and you make something else out of it. And the substance stays, but the various forms change. Or if you have an acting troupe, a group of actors, so they get into a particular costume and they perform a particular drama. Now, the drama is real in the sense that it's occurring. It's not false in the Mayavadi sense of it having no existence at all. But what's false is that the actors are not those characters. And after the drama, they take off their costumes, they take off their makeup, they get out of character, and then they do a different drama. And the same actors play different roles. So, you know, the actors who the protagonist in one drama is the antagonist in another drama. The actor who has a leading role in one drama has a peripheral role in another drama. Some actors may totally sit out a particular drama. But it's the basic, the stage, the sets, the makeups, the fabric, they stay there. But the different forms, shift. And if someone thinks, you know, well, I'm in this drama, this is my reality, this is where I'm invested. This is where I'm invested. My pleasure is here. How my spouse treats me, what kind of personality my spouse has, how my children treat me, how my parents treat me, how my government treats me. How my body treats me. This is the source of my pleasure. This is my field. And you're working with some ever-shifting, unreal, insubstantial forms of a real substrate that never changes. How frustrating. So therefore, we have Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati saying to us, the world is in no need of any reformer. The world has a very competent person for guiding its minutest happenings. The person who finds that there is scope for reform of the world himself stands in need of reform. The world goes on its own perfect way. No person can deflect it by the breath of a hair from the course chalked out for it by providence. Wow. Wow. Let's read this again. The world is in no need of any reformer. The world has a very competent person for guiding its minutest happenings. The person who finds that there is scope for reform of the world himself stands in need of reform. The world goes on its own perfect way. No person can deflect it by the breath of a hair from the course chalked out for it by providence. Whew. Sounds like a defeatist nihilistic view. Well, we see, wait a minute, it seems that people change the course of history, but do they? I like to think of the story of Gandhari and Duryodhan and Bhima. So Duryodhan, when they captured Draupadi, pulled her in by the hair, brought her into the arena during the gambling match. And when Draupadi was lost by Yudhisthira's gambling, so Duryodhan said to her, come and sit on my thigh. He slapped his thigh, you know, come sit on my lap. So you don't say to someone else's wife, come sit on my lap. So Bhima was so angry that Duryodhan had insulted his wife like this, that Bhima said, I take a vow. He said, I will break your thighs. So Bhima had this determination, how he wanted to affect the world, what he wanted to accomplish. But then Duryodhan has people who love him too, you know. So Gandhari, she loved her son. This is normal. Parents love their children, even if their children are criminals. They still love them. So Gandhari loved her son, Duryodhan. She wanted the best for him. She wanted him to live. And in the battle of Kurukshetra, she wasn't doing very well. Her sons, she had 100 sons, many grandsons. They were all being slaughtered. And one of the main person killing them was Bhima. So it got to the point that only Duryodhan was left, her eldest. And she wanted to try to save him. So Gandhari had some power due to austerity. Factually, all the power anyone has in any sphere is due to austerity. So she asked Duryodhan to come see her without wearing any clothes. She said, don't wear any clothes and come and see me. So Duryodhan thought that that was rather odd. But in that society, people were obedient to their superiors in a way that is inconceivable for us at the present time. We can't imagine anybody being that obedient, that compliant with somebody just because they're in a superior position. I mean, when Kunti told the Pandavas, you all share Draupadi equally, they didn't feel that they could disobey her order. The concept of disobeying an order of a superior was practically unknown. You know, Bali Maharaj, who disobeyed Shukracharya's order to lie to Vamandev and withdraw his offer of land, was very extraordinary. Or Bibhishan, who rebelled against his older brother. Bharat, who refused to take the kingdom that Kaikeyi had arranged for him. So these were very extraordinary in that society. There was a very strong, and you still see this to some extent, and, you know, it's being destroyed. But places like Japan and Korea In China, the one-child policy has destroyed the family almost entirely, but you found that sort of obedience to family and tradition, a lot of the Indian villages, places like Bangladesh, Pakistan, Indonesia, you find this. Like this just obedience. So Duryodhan didn't say to his mother, Mom, you know, I'm grown up now. You know, a little baby, of course the mother sees the little baby, a boy naked. He comes out of her body naked and she's bathing him and changing him. And for quite some years, the mother is regularly seeing her son naked. But you don't expect that the mother sees the mature son naked. That would be rather odd. Wouldn't be proper etiquette, proper behavior wouldn't be appropriate. So, but Duryodhan didn't say that. He didn't say, wait a minute, mother, you know, I'm a grown man, and it's no longer appropriate for me to come before you without clothes. So although, you know, he certainly knew that, he felt my mother's order is superior. Now, of course, in a society where people obey their authorities like that, the authorities have to be very highly qualified. You have to have authorities who don't mistreat and abuse and exploit their subordinates. And the main reason why we don't have this view of authority now is that people misused that power of authority. You know, from the medieval, from the brahmanas who misused it, like Sringi, to the medieval kings who misused it, the men who misused it, the parents who misused it, the natural authorities in society, the teachers, are no longer respected like that. Government officials, they're just, people don't have that kind of respect for authority. But anyway, he did. So what's kind of strange to me is in the story, he was walking to her tent on the battlefield naked. I mean, I would think he would have worn something to walk around and he could take it off at the last minute once he got to her tent. But anyway, that wasn't what he did. He was walking around without any clothes. So the way at least some of the Mahabharats tell it is that Krishna came to see him. Krishna passed by and said to Duryodhan, what are you doing? Why are you naked? And Duryodhan said, well, my mother told me to come see her naked. And Krishna says, you're going to see your mother naked? You're grown up now. He said, well, that's her order. He said, what specifically did she say? Did she say, come naked? He said, no. She said, come without clothes. He said, well, why don't you put on something that's not clothes? Take a leaf. Take like a big banana leaf and just put it around your private parts, and that way you'll be in proper decorum, but you won't be wearing any clothes. So that's what Duryodhan did. And he came in to see his mother. And his mother, of course, had been blindfolded since she found out that Dhritarashtra would be blind. She didn't want to feel that she was better than her husband. So this was also another mood that it's very hard for us to relate to in the modern world. You know, everyone thinks they're better than their authorities. The disciple thinks they know more than their guru. The wife thinks she's a better person than her husband. The children think they're better people than their parents. The voters think they know more than the presidents. I mean, it's a general mood that I don't have to listen to my authority and I know more than them and I'm a better person than them and so forth. But Gandhari didn't have this mood. She had this mood that although she was better, she could see. She was better in character also. But if even physiologically, she was sighted and her husband-to-be wasn't. And she thought, I don't want any sense of pride, so let me also become blind. I mean, you could say, well, that's not very practical. If your husband's blind, it'd be good if you could see and you could help him. But they were high royalty. They had plenty of servants, and that was not really a problem or consideration for her. So having done this austerity for the sake of serving her husband, she had had great powers. So she removed her blindfold for the first time in decades, and she looked at the body of Duryodhan, and her glance, by her intention, made his body like iron, except the part that was covered by the leaves. And when she noticed that he still had something covered by leaves, she said, who told you to do this? Why did you do this? And he said, well, Krishna advised me in that way. So then when Bhima and Duryodhan were fighting later that day, the rule of fighting with clubs is that you only hit above the waist. That's the rule. But Krishna slapped his thigh, reminding Bhima of how Duryodhan had slapped his thigh and how Bhima had this vow to break the thigh of Duryodhan. And then Bhima hit Duryodhan in the thigh, the upper portion of the thigh, which had been covered by the banana leaf, and that being a vulnerable part, Duryodhan went through a very slow, agonizing death off the battlefield and out of the presence of Krishna. The point here that Duryodhan was destined to die in this way. And whatever plans were done by Gandhari, she was allowed to do her plan. She was allowed to have her son come to her. She was allowed to use her powers. But she wasn't able to affect the ultimate outcome. The ultimate outcome was already there. I think of it like water flowing down to the sea. There can be so many obstacles. There's so many rocks and cliffs, and the water goes down the cliff and makes a waterfall. Right? Even a dam, they build these huge dams, but if there's enough rain, the dam breaks or the dam overflows. That the Krishna is able to integrate all of our desires and all of our little plans and all of our little things into his overall plan. And while the details shift according to our desires, the ultimate plan goes on the way it goes on. None of us, are, as Bhaktisiddhanta says, are able to affect it by a hair's breadth. Well, then what does he go on to say? So that may be kind of discouraging, and all of this may sort of bring us to a nihilistic idea of why should I do anything? And indeed, those who become advanced in Gyan Yoga, Karma Yoga, they do in fact come to this position, especially Gyan Yoga and Gyan Yoga. They come to this position of why bother to do anything? Why bother to act in the world at all? And in fact, they don't act in the world. The great Gyanis and the great Jnana Yogis, they retire from the world. They go to some secluded place. The Jnana Yogis, they just meditate within. They go into a trance of samadhi where they don't hear or see or feel the world at all. They lose all awareness of the world. And the Jnanis simply immerse themselves in philosophy and the study of the scripture and the futility of material life. And they don't, again, they're not active in the world. Even the karma yogis, who are active in the world, they're active in the world karma palatyaga. They've renounced the fruits of their work. They're working simply because that's the duty given to them by God and by their nature. And they're really working for the purpose of detachment and liberation. They're not working for the purpose of trying to change the world or affect anything in the world. So that's the natural result of spirituality and of yoga. Whatever tradition one is in, whatever process one is in, when one sees the absurdity of trying to affect any change in the world and the absurdity of even thinking that one can do that, one becomes very detached. So what does Bhaktisiddhanta go on and say? He says, what is necessary is to change our outlook to this very world. The scriptures declare that it is only necessary to listen with an open mind to the name of Krishna from the lips of a bona fide devotee. As soon as Krishna enters the listening ear, he clears up the vision of the listener so that he no longer has any ambition of ever acting the part of a reformer of any other person, because he finds that nobody is left without the very highest guidance. It is therefore his own reform by the grace of God, whose supreme necessity and nature he is increasingly able to realize by the eternally continuing mercy of the Supreme Lord. So there is one thing we can change. There is something we can change. We can't change the nature of our body and mind. We can't change that. We can't change the trajectory of the world. But we can change our outlook to this world. We can see that as Bhaktisiddhanta is saying, by hearing Krishna from the lips of a bona fide devotee, by the sound vibration of the holy name of the Lord, by especially he's emphasizing here hearing, by hearing transcendental sound vibration, we start to see the world as it is. We see the world in reality. We see past the curtain and we see it authentically. And then we realize that on the mundane level, everything is already perfect. Even on the spiritual level, everything is already perfect. Interestingly enough, the bhakti yogi acts in the world generally more like the karma yogi than the gyan yogi or the jnana yogi. Certainly, we sometimes act like the Gyan Yogis and that we're, like right now, we're discussing philosophy. And we may be acting like the Gyan Yogis during our Japa and Gayatri times. But generally, we're acting very much like the Karma Yogis, that we're active in the world. Or aren't we trying to change things? Aren't we trying to build a temple? Aren't we trying to sell a book? No, we're not. We're not. Superficially, we are. But even for the Karma Yogis, they're Karma Palatyaga. They've given up attachment to the fruits of their work. What we're really trying to do when we're active in the world is just to please Krishna and change our consciousness. Now, interestingly enough, Bhaktisiddhanta says in this section here, this article, that if we hear Krishna from the lips of a devotee, it will change our vision. He says we can't be the reformer of any other person, but we can be the reformer of someone if we have purity and say the name of Krishna. How interesting. I cannot reform somebody else materially. Unless they're open to it, unless Krishna sanctions it, I may appear to be the reformer, but I'm acting as an instrument of divine will. But on this spiritual platform, then I can truly be a reformer. That is the platform on which we can effect meaningful change in ourselves and others. And that is the only platform on which we can effect meaningful change in ourselves and others. And when change happens on that platform, then it ripples out into the material platform. So when we realize that we are a spiritual being, when we realize that there's a God, we realize that we are the servant of God, then we have peripheral or secondary benefits of that. We become moral, we become ethical, we become compassionate. We develop all the qualities of sattva-gun. And by developing the qualities of sattva-gun, then we do change, even materially. We may not change our basic nature, whether we're shy or outgoing or something like that, but we can be shy in sattva-gun or outgoing in sattva-gun. So in that way, we reform. The reform on the material level is secondary. The reason in Satyayuga the whole earth is like a garden and we don't need agriculture, in the beginning of Satyayuga they don't even need government, is because people are engaged in deep meditation on the Lord, and therefore their consciousness and their vision is changed. So as I say many times, yes, we need to do things externally, you know, sure. Your bed's broken and giving you a backache, you know, buy a new bed. People are hungry, go and cook. I mean, that's just practical. Of course, ultimately, we really don't need to do that even. There are great realized souls who live as avadutas who don't do any of that. But okay, we're, you know, practical. Your finger's cut, you put a bandage on it. That's practical. But the bulk of our energy should be into changing our vision of the world, to clearing our consciousness. And when we've cleared our consciousness, then we know how to work with other people and how to work with the material nature. Not in the mood of a doer, in the mood of just an instrument of Krishna's will. That Krishna's will is there, how can I work with him? How can I be the little fish flowing in the river? My good friend Srimati in Vrindavan, she says, go from stone to fish. The river is flowing to the sea. Are we a stone impeding the river that Krishna has to go around us and over us and under us? And Krishna still makes sure everything gets where it's going, but we've been an impediment. Or are we a fish swimming in the current? Delighting in the flow of the current, delighting in the plan of the Lord, and cooperating in the plan of the Lord. Are we dancing with the plan of the Lord? And when we do that, then the devotee appears to do amazing, wonderful things. that transformed the world. And it really transformed the world. The devotees like Lord Jesus Christ. He just preaches for a few years. What was he preaching? Only like 3 years. And the world, it affected, you know, millions, billions of people for thousands of years. So that we can do. That is delightful, and that makes us feel very happy. So that's where we should be putting our energy. Yes, we have to do, you know, practical things. We have to put fuel in our car and wash our floor, teach our children to be polite. The bulk of our energy should be into pure hearing and chanting, to change our vision, to change our consciousness. And once we change our consciousness, then we'll be able to have a meaningful life. Then we can affect others. We can affect a person who's fully realized in higher consciousness can change others and change the world. Lava matra sadhu sangha sarva shastra koi. Sadhu sangha, sadhu sangha sarva shastra koi. Lava matra sadhu sangha sarva siddhi hoy. In an 11th of a second, in just a moment, a glance of the great devotee, a word of a great devotee, the foot dust from a great devotee, the food remnants of a great devotee. You can say, well, I can't become a great devotee, but I can become the servant of the servant of a great devotee. That I can do. And I can be a conduit for the mercy of that great devotee. Then everything has meaning in our life. Every moment in our life is filled with meaning. Every moment in our life is filled with satisfaction. So that is how we should deal with the material nature. So questions, comments?
Hare Krishna.
Yes. Yes, Pandita.
Well, I think pretty much you've answered my question, how transcendental changes in consciousness, you know, is transformative. You know, that is the only thing. And because nihilistic thinking is life is meaningless, that's depressing. It's just horrible. And I used to feel that way before coming to Krishna consciousness. And I think it contributed, unfortunately, to the suicide of my mother. Mm. She didn't have Krishna consciousness. And I think it would have changed her so much. She knew, you know.
Yeah.
But I just think it's such a shame that devotees, that either they're just absorbed in their family life or whatever, that aren't transformed by your writings and by your classes. I mean, my God, I feel so enlivened by your classes. You just can't imagine, and it's transformative. And, you know, before I, you know, came to Krishna consciousness, the paintings, you know, I'd get it back to Godhead magazine, and it was just beautiful, colorful paintings of the Rasa Leela dance, you know, the older one, the oldest one that Devahuti did, and Mother Yasoda and Lord Krishna, and you know, I just knew that this was above and way, you know, nothing material, and just so attractive. And then Ravinder Sarup's paper on guru reform, I mean, that just transformed all of this con. So, anyway, that does make the point that, yes, you know, Krishna consciousness can transform and change things. But, you know, I feel it's just very unfortunate and sad that, you know, that your writings that you worked so hard on don't seem to make a difference in changes.
Oh, it's not sad. It's really,
I feel transformative in my heart.
Oh, it's not sad. It's Krishna's mercy to keep me a little bit humble. Harsh, you have a nice statement. You say, if it's all false, why are there so many dharmas like Sri Putra Dharma? Why are there accounts of pious and impious deeds? So that's for persons who are very determined and very fixed at trying to think that this world is their karma bhumi, that this world is their kshetra, kshetra jam chapi mambidhi, sarva kshetra shichbharata, that this world is their field of action, that they're going to come here and enjoy the world and master the world. So such is the mentality of the vast majority of human beings. So the vast, vast majority of a soul who's taken birth in a human body is going to be in this rajagun, in this mode of passion, that I want to be the enjoyer of the world. So all of these mundane dharmas are given so that people can, first of all, factually have some enjoyment in the world. If you're going to, because the material energy is Krishna's energy, it's not false. Because it is Krishna's energy, there is a way of dealing with Krishna's energy that is more pleasing than other ways of dealing with Krishna's energy. So they're saying, okay, if you want to exploit Krishna's energy, you can't really do that. The concept of exploiting Krishna's energy is false. However, if you try to exploit Krishna's energy in this way, you'll get a better result than if you try to exploit it in this way. So that's to facilitate, to facilitate people's false desires. It's just like, you know, if you want to lose your awareness of your life and get absorbed in entertainment. So therefore the entertainment industry creates dramas and music and theater and film and all these things. So Krishna says, you want to become absorbed in something illusory? All right, this is how to do it. So that's one reason. The other reason is that if you do it according to that way, not only will you get more fulfillment than if you try to do things in a sinful way, but as soon as you're following these different dharmas, that means you have some connection with the Shastras and with the Brahmanas. You know, Putra Dharma, that's given in the Shastra. Krishna says to Vasudeva and Devaki, any child who can't, you know, grown-up child who can't serve his parents, who doesn't serve his parents even though he's capable, they'll have to suffer for so many years. Or, you know, in the Bhagavatam it says the woman should keep the house clean and neat and nice smelling and dress beautifully for her husband. And so that's there. But then you're in touch with the Shastra. Okay, and then you're in touch with the Brahmanas. And if you're in touch with the Brahmanas and you're in touch with the Shastra, then you're also going to read about bhakti. Then you're likely also to contact a great devotee. You know, and then you get the real thing. That's, you know, just like people go to a place of worship, a church, a temple, a mosque, a synagogue, for somebody's wedding. Well, they don't care about God. They're just going for somebody's wedding. But it takes place in a place of worship. It takes place in a religious place. So they'll get some contact with God. They get some contact with the reality. I mean, it used to be in human society that practically every festival, every observance was connected somehow with God. So if you're connecting, you know, why are you following this being a good wife? Why are you following being a good husband, being a good son, being a good citizen? Because it says, where are you getting this idea of what is good? Where does it come from? How do I determine what is good? You know, in the present day, the concepts of what is a good husband, what is a good wife, what is a good child, what is a good parent are so different than they were when I was growing up. I mean, just radically different. So where does this come from? How do I know whether I'm a good wife? On what basis do I judge? So we say you judge by the Shastra. Otherwise, you just make it up. I think a good wife does this. I think a good wife does that. I think a good husband does this. Now, that has no meaning at all. And you follow the Shastra, then you're in touch with the Shastra. Well, look at that. So, in that way, you go to the ultimate. But even materially, there's different ways of handling the material energy that are more or less satisfying. So even from an illusory perspective, you know, it doesn't have any ultimate reality in the sense that it's not who you really are. But the closer you get connected with Krishna and the way Krishna wants to do it, this is a big topic in the Bhagavatam. Why does it seem that God favors the demigods if he's neutral? And that's because the material nature in general favors the mode of goodness. So the closer you get to the mode of goodness, the happier you are even in the illusion. Is that all right? Okay, anybody else?
Yes, I have a question. I'll try and make this understandable if it's possible. In the purport, Prabhupada says that the systematic activities of the time factor are eternal and cannot be therefore false, at least as far as how the Maya bodies conceive it. I have been trying to study a little bit about Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Okay.
And he states, there's this famous quote he said a few times, you know, when he was alive, that time is an illusion, even though it's quite persistent.
Yes.
At least the way we do it. So there's, you have all of matter, all of space, and it can be divided up into quadrants like that. The same with time, past, present, future, whatever tense, it has certain quadrants. So they're intimately connected. So that's why he coined time-space.
Mm.
And therefore, he said, just as all of space exists, same with time, our conception of past, present, and future is simply an illusion.
Yes.
So how much of that can we agree with? It almost sounds like the virata.
Yes.
The conception of the universal form.
It is very much so. When Arjuna saw the universal form on the battlefield, he saw past, present, and future all occurring at the same time. And he saw all of space in one place.
Okay. Then the physicists, well, theoretical physicists will point out, well, therefore, there's no such thing as free will. That's an illusion as well. Because
okay,
everything's already existing.
Because everything's already existing. Well, this is the... I'll see if I can find something for you. I'm sure I've read it here before. So this is a perpetual philosophical question, that if Krishna knows the future, if the future is already existing in the present, if the future is not something that unfolds, then it seems that all we're doing is going on a pre-planned trajectory. Now, in a sense, that's true. And again, if we're going to think of illusion as a film, you know, so there's, you know, you have a movie theater. There's a local movie theater. I have no idea how many screens they have. I haven't been there. But let's say you have a movie theater that has 10 screens, 10 different movies that are showing. And the movies are also showing at different times. So you choose what movie you want to see at what time. You're making that choice. And once you go into the theater and you sit down, you are carried away by that movie. You know, I see this in planes all the time. So I'll be in an airplane, and the back of every seat there's a little screen, and this, you know, there can be, the planes advertise, we have whatever, 100 movies you can choose from. And so different people are watching different things. So they're choosing what they want to watch. But once they're watching, they're carried along by that story. The storyteller is carrying them along, and at this point in the story, they're going to laugh, and at this point in the story, they're going to cry, and at this point in the story, they're going to be angry. Right? And that's exactly what happens. So, you know, you sit next to the person, and they laugh at that point, and they cry at that point, and so forth. So where's your free will? your free will is being manipulated by the storyteller. Now, where's your free will? Well, you could choose what story you wanted to be absorbed in. You could choose when you wanted to be absorbed in it. You can also choose to walk away from the story. You can choose to say, I'm going to turn this off and I'm going to walk away. Now, what you're absorbed in now is going to influence what you absorb in when that's over. So if you were, you know, watching a romance and you liked it, then you're likely to want to watch another romance. If you watched a romance and you didn't like it, then maybe you're going to want to watch a documentary. So there's certain choice points. Actually, there's a choice point all the time. Prabhupada says imperceptibly, Krishna is giving us a choice at every moment. You also have a choice as to how to respond to the story, how much you get drawn into it, what characters you identify with, even though the story is kind of unwinding on its own. So there's a nice section from the... I'm going to read for this is from a lecture in Bhagavad Gita 925 in New York, November 23rd, 1966. Narada Muni goes generally to Narayan, another planet. So yes, too, one Brahmin and one cobbler, they inquired like this, so how may I know what is their destination? So Narayana said, well, yes, the cobbler, this after giving up this body, he's coming here at Vaikuntha. What about the Brahmana? Oh, he has to remain there still so many births, or I do not know when he is coming. So Lord Narayana is telling Narada Muni, I don't know how soon the Brahmin is coming. This is from a letter to Madhavisa, July 31st, 1970. He says, because Krishna know everyone's future, does not remove our free will. Someone may commit a theft, and if I know that, then I know that he will be captured and punished. That is knowing his future. But know that future does not mean that he had no choice not to commit the criminal act. There are two destinies for everyone. One destiny is in Krishna consciousness, and the other destiny is in material consciousness. So if someone is in Krishna consciousness, then Krishna knows his future. And if he's in material consciousness and acting in that way, then Krishna also knows his future. In this way, the free will is not affected by knowing the future of the living being. That is an erroneous conclusion. The way I understand this is that the future is constantly in flux. And Krishna says that material nature is endlessly mutable. The future always exists. Future always exists. It's not really something we're coming to. That's an illusion. But it's constantly in flux. And it's changing according to the decisions that we are each making at this moment. And Krishna always knows what it is. It's always existing, and yet it's always changing. It's constantly shifting. In fact, that's what Arjuna saw in the universal form. He saw things constantly shifting. Now, certain things in the future are absolutely fixed. There are certain things that are the will of God. Like I was saying, the water goes down to the ocean. That's fixed. You cannot change that. But you can change, you know, are you a rock or are you a fish? Are you a rock here or are you a rock there? That you can change. And so the specific path of the water down to the ocean is going to change according to how the living entities respond. And your experience as a living entity is going to be different depending on how you respond to what's going on. Your happiness and distress is going to change. This is a nice story from the Chaitanya Bhagavat. This is from the Majjhakanda chapter 2. It's a little long. I think I'll read this and then we can end. This is a nice example of how Krishna's ultimate plan for the future works, but the details are unfolding. He says, Srivas is most dear to the Lord. Therefore, the Lord blessed him and everyone present by placing his lotus feet upon their heads. Smiling, Vishnambar said, may your attachment and attraction for me increase. The Lord spoke loudly like a roaring lion in addressing Srivas says, oh, Srivasa, are you afraid of something? News has reached me that the government men want to capture you, and they have come with two boats. I am the super soul within everyone's heart. Thus I control and direct everyone's activities according to my sweet will. The king can only capture you if I, being situated in his heart, prompt him to do so. Yet, if for some reason he acts independently and gives the order to capture you, so first Lord Chaitanya is saying, I control everyone and he can only capture you if I sanction it, and then he says, but he might do it anyway. If for some reason he acts independently and gives the order to capture you, then I will do the following. I will be the first to step into the boat and present myself before the king. Upon seeing me, do you think that he can remain seated upon the throne? I will delude him, take control of him, and drag him down. So he says, you know, if the king doesn't listen to me, a super soul, I'll come before him and I'll drag him from his throne. He says, should this not happen? He's got a plan C here. Then I will tell the king, listen to the truth, O king. Call all of your religious heads and judges to the court. Collect all of your elephants, horses, animals, and birds. Whatever creatures you have, bring them to your palace. Then order all your Qazi priests to read from your scriptures and inspire the creatures to such a state of spiritual emotion that they begin to cry. When his priests fail to do so, then I will reveal my potency to the king. I will say, O king, on the instructions of these same Qazi priests whose lack of spiritual power we have already witnessed, you want to forbid the congregational chanting of the holy name of Krishna. Now you shall see my power to the full satisfaction of your eyes. Then I shall capture a mad elephant and bring him before the king along with other elephants, horses, deer, and other animals, and instantly make them all cry in ecstasy and chant Krishna's name. I will make the king and all his men cry and chant Krishna's name. I know that you don't believe that this is possible, but I will show you right now and you can see for yourself. The Lord noticed a small girl who was the daughter of Sri Vaspandi's brother named Narayani. The brother wasn't named Narayani, the girl's named Narayani. Lord Gaurachandra, the Supreme Godhead, the Super Soul within everyone's heart, ordered the little girl, Narayani, chant Krishna's name and cry in ecstasy. The four-year-old girl became extremely agitated with ecstatic spiritual emotions and cried out, Oh, Krishna! She began to weep, losing all perception of the external world. Tears streamed down her body and she fell to the ground. Smiling, Lord Vishwambar asked Shivas, Are your fears pacified now? So this is a very instructive story about free will and knowing the future. So Lord Chaitanya is saying, the future is that you will be successful, that you don't have anything to fear from the Qazi. That's the future. How will it happen? Well, I'll try by force. First, I'm going to force, as a super soul, I'm going to say, do this. But I can't force because people have free will. So he may not listen to me. Then I'm going to try to force externally. I'll go to the king and drag him off his throne. But that may not work. He said, then I will try to convince him by a display of spiritual power. I'll show him the impotence of his own religious leaders and I'll show my own potency. But somehow or other, we will have this final result is that you will not be imprisoned, you will not be persecuted by the king, and don't worry about it. So this is the interplay between the free will of the living entity and the Lord knowing the future and the future always existing. So the future always existing is some ultimate fixed things by the Lord are there, and no matter what we do, that's what's going to happen. And then other things which are constantly in flux, and the Lord being aware of that future constantly as it changes. And as we make our decisions, and even more extraordinarily, the Lord weaving together all of our different choices that produce still the karma and the desires of all living entities, plus the Lord's desire, and how he does that, I haven't the foggiest notion, and I doubt if I ever will. It's already 7:15. Vidagdha Madhava, if it's brief, because I do need to get going, I have an appointment this morning.
Okay, I'll try to edit it down. Fascinating class. Absolutely, you know, I was absorbed start to finish. Some of what you said reminds me of Srila Shudamarsh, you know, saying, you know, wasting your time trying to change the environment, things outside of yourself. So, but he takes it further. You know, you can only change yourself, but he takes it further. And he says the environment is friendly if you can develop that angle of vision. It's pushing you in the right direction. But you have to change your outlook, like you were saying.
Yes.
Can't change your nature, but you can change your outlook. So, but here's my question. You know, we're engaged. We've been given the holy name, and we've been given 10 offenses to avoid in chanting that holy name. And although we can't change our nature, that was fascinating. Somebody's introverted, somebody's outgoing. But at the same time, you know, we see in this Kali Yuga, everybody's just, you know, diving in an ocean of pride. You know, Prabhupada would say a pauper is proud of his penny. You know, everybody's proud of something. And so that has to go. And so in a way,
that's everyone's nature, this pride.
Yes.
And so we have to change our perception of ourselves and also of others. And I've heard you in previous classes, and there's a natural way to come to this position of humility. And is another a way also to naturally feel like you want to honor others and not look for it yourself. So that has to change.
Oh, absolutely. And what Harsh was asking previously, why is there, you know, Pucha Dharma, Stri Dharma, and then he wrote it in a private comment. But he said it's teaching subordination in our rebellion. So, you know, our tendency in this world is that we want to do whatever we want, and we don't want to follow anybody. The citizens don't want to follow the government. Children don't want to listen to their parents. Women don't want to listen to their husbands. You know, the students don't want to listen to their teachers. Employees don't want to listen to their employer. Why should we? You know, they're not better than we are. We know as much as or more as they do. Why should we listen to them? And in one sense, it's a fact. You know, just because somebody's your employer doesn't mean they're more intelligent or a better person than you. Just because someone's your husband, just because they're your mother or father, just because they're the president. I mean, in fact, you may be a better person than them. But there's these things even materially in place to teach us humility and to teach us obedience. And that has to change. That's not our nature. Pridefulness is not part of either our mundane swabhava or our transcendental swabhava. On the transcendental level, we're totally full of humility. We think everyone's better than we are. And on the material level, even if you're a kshatriya, you know, Yudhisthira, Bhima, Arjuna, they were pure devotees, full of total humility. I mean, you may say, well, Bhima was a dhirodhata, but he was very humble. He just saw himself as a simple servant of Krishna. He didn't see himself as better than anyone else. Yudhisthira, who was Dharmaraj himself, he was the personification of Dharma, and he could say at the question of whether the five brothers should all marry Draupadi, he could make a statement, I have thought of this, and anything that comes to my mind must be Dharma. Wow! Could we say that? Could we say anything I think of must be Dharma? What a statement. And yet, when he was asked to find anyone in the world who was higher than him, he couldn't find anybody. He didn't think anybody was better than him. So that mood of service and pridelessness, yes, when Bhaktisiddhanta says the only reform that we can make is to change our consciousness, that the only sense in which we can reform ourselves or others or anything is to change our consciousness, he's particularly talking about a consciousness of humility and pridelessness. But, we don't want to become humble separate from love. To try to become humble and prideless, separate from love, we go into Gyan. And we're going into liberation. Adi Purusha Prabhu, who teaches at the VIHE and teaches a lot in Europe, he was saying one time in a class how he felt at one point that his main duty was to develop good qualities, and then from there he could become Krishna conscious. But it's really by becoming Krishna conscious we develop good qualities. If I really have even any degree of love for Krishna, then why would I want to overlord any other living being? So the natural humility, there's an interplay between humility and love, that love produces humility, humility produces love. Love without humility has no meaning at all. It's just exploitive. And humility without love, you know, then that's just liberation. But thank you for bringing that up. Yes, it is. The pride is our covering. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.